Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Abarca with Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. And on today's episode, we are each in our individual homes on a Skype call. And we will be discussing the pearls of distance learning or online education in the midst of the unfolding COVID-19 crisis, where lots of things have actually transformed our lives in almost every part of the sector in our society. And last episode, we had discussed the service industry as it was badly hit, and Kenny spoke to us from that on a personal experience. Now, Andy, as most of our audience and listeners know, is a high school science teacher, and he has personally experienced some of the transformative things that are happening in public education. And you will be telling us about that on this episode now, Andy. Before we start the episode, though, I think it's quite important that our listeners and viewers understand that sometimes the topics that we discuss can be such, for example, last we spoke with Kenny, it was a service industry, and now it's public education. And we might think, how are these connected? In any part of our society, every sector of our society, as workers, we all have a stake in all of these sectors, because we have families, we are individuals with colleagues and our comrades that are in every part of this section of society that is affected, that we live with, that we are in relationship with, or that we should democratically have a say in how those function. And any of you can say more to that. I just wanted to give this a very broad sort of reason why we need to have every one of us say something about it, even if we're not directly involved, like we're not directly a teacher. Like, I'm not a teacher in public education at the moment, and I still have lots of thoughts and opinions to share and my views to give. And so I do think that everyone has to say something democratically, even in a socialist society. And both of you can add to that if you wish. I'm not sure if that's clear. I want to be sure that's...
I would say especially in an actual socialist society where working class democracy is at the center of socialism. Yes.
Yeah.
Kenny?
I mean, yeah, I agree that, you know, education and, we will have education. You know, young students now are going to be the workers of the future. And, you know, it's important to pay attention as to, you know, the big, ideas behind, you know, these moves. And so, yeah, I mean, we will have a stake in this. You know, it's not just those kids or those teachers that are, you know, in the system at the moment. But I think it brings up the past, the present, and obviously the future, which is very important.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying this, Eduardo, in the beginning. Of course, it's important to remember that since I'm a teacher and you're a paraprofessional and Kenny isn't really formally in education at all, that my points of view are the most important.
Kenny, that one up for sure.
I just want our audience members to remember that I'm the authority here. Kenny, I mean, or Eduardo kind of knows what he's talking about, and Kenny has no idea.
No, we're cutting that off.
Censorship.
Andy is being no, facetious.
I am not being, I'm being facetious, of course, but in some ways I'm speaking to an actual problem that exists in education that many teachers see themselves not as workers, but as professionals.
I see.
And so I want to be clear that I 100% endorse what Eduardo was saying, but there is a problem within the class that many teachers don't see themselves as workers. Certainly not ones that, you know, we tell our paraprofessionals, but some people talk about them as my paraprofessional that is in my class.
Yes.
And as opposed to a colleague, and certainly not the person who might be cleaning up or the cafeteria worker, where maybe, Kenny, your line of work would be closer to that person in it.
Yeah.
And to actually think of you even outside of the school providing food as part of the education process. I mean, that's the mindset that workers are ultimately going to have, is to see the world as a net of work that we are all just a part of.
Yeah, in that context, yes, Andy, I appreciate you having said that. I have worked with my colleagues who have been teachers, and they have been very condescending to staff, to janitors, to teacher assistants, to secretaries. I know the climate.
Can I ask? Yeah. So you brought up, you know, this idea of worker versus a professional. What is a professional? Well, what is the difference?
I think what people might say is, look, I got my certificate, I went to college, I have this thing, this piece of paper that says I have certain qualifications. You don't have them. He doesn't have them. Yeah. So because of that, you know, this is why my pay might be higher, why your pay might be lower, and it's a justification. I think of it as an indoctrination of education, or education system, higher education, to make me feel different than you as a worker.
Okay.
I mean, that's all it really is. I mean, in my opinion. And just be clear. I've worked with paraprofessionals in my classroom. I've done good work that way. But I will say, even myself, I have fallen down on that. Like, I can think of one paraprofessional I worked with where I felt like I did not do right by her in the classroom. So I'm not going to pretend that I'm some sort of whatever, you know. I feel like overall I've done a good job, but I feel like I've fallen into that trap as well. So I don't want to act like this is nothing that I've ever done.
I have to always feel like I have to prove myself how smart, how organized, how well-educated I am with teachers sometimes for them to take me seriously. Because when I've worked in the classroom as an assistant or as a para interpreter, most of the time I feel they already have a view of what that's like. And then when I start organizing, when I'm involved in the union, when I'm doing my work with the students, then they see the value. And I don't have to work twice as hard. They wouldn't do that with a first or second even year teacher.
Yeah.
You know. But anyhow.
And just speaking from the bottom over here, the totem pole, a little bit of, you know, about the professional, this identity about, you know, superiority, or, you know, like we notice that there's plenty of people that dismiss a lot of restaurant workers, restaurant, you know, service industry work, you know, and think that people are brutes and have no opinions, you know, and they know better. You know, that's why I'm so harsh on like liberal politics, because it can be very condescending and gives priority to, you know, again, people that have gotten licensed, even though they might be complete idiots, because, you know, like, but they have the certificate and somehow gives you obviously mobility within this system. But just speaking from the bottom over here, if you allow me.
No. I don't really think it's the bottom, but I know what you're talking
about.
No. Because that's the way the hierarchy is in capitalism.
Yeah.
I understand it completely. And I have seen many of our lunch ladies or even lunch men be very intelligent, know like five languages, come from different countries, their experiences. It's amazing. And but yes, I know what you're talking about. That's how capitalism is.
One last thought, like again, working in the restaurant industry, a lot of people that are dishwashers, they were actually like lawyers and professionals in their countries, but they can't, you know, exercise their professions here because there is not just the legal issues, but the, you know, language barrier, cultural barriers. But it's, you know, like there's agricultural engineers, there's former nurses, you know, people with like, again, that would be considered professionals here, but, you know, they're just washing dishes and, you know, they're, it's just about.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. All right, let's segue into our topic, but it's all related. And one thing I'm going to sort of frame this is as what I wish we will. I will link this in our description box below, where Naomi Klein, an author, activist, environmentalist, and anti-capitalist, had said that there are. She released a video recently. She's part of The Intercept, and she said there are ideas that are lying around that when a crisis, when a disaster happens, such as a hurricane, an earthquake, right now a pandemic, or war, suddenly what was impossible becomes possible. And this is when capitalists exploit the crisis. Because what there was an idea, for example, in today's topic, we'll be discussing about online learning, distance learning, was something maybe unfathomable for many teachers, suddenly has become possible and might even become the new norm if we allow it. And in this pandemic and the financial hardships, and as more unfolding information is happening in this pandemic of COVID-19, there are the private sector is wanting to capitalize on this moment to take online distance to a new level. And there are teachers like yourself, Andy, that are pushing back. And so I think what we're going to be discussing, I think however you want to do this format, is we're going to be discussing what you and your colleagues are putting out there in resistance to this, trying to make this a new normal of online distance learning.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess to say that there are, the analogy I've used for what's happening in public education is sort of the, like when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and it created a context for gentrifying whole regions of the city, and putting up condominiums and displacing poor people and putting up either new housing so that you could, people can make a bunch of money off of real estate in the city. One of the side effects, or one of the additional effects of that, was the turning of the public education system in New Orleans into a charter school system, and basically public education was eradicated. That was one of, that's something that's been wanted to be done by the corporations, by the ones who want to privatize education and who see in all the money that's in education an opportunity for them to get a piece of the action and turn it into a for-profit venture and make money off of that. And by no stretch do I see what's taking place right now in public education as like, I don't think that capitalist interests were like, oh, here comes coronavirus, now let's privatize education. But I do see that in the actions of quarantine that are being established across the country and in the need to, for schools to sell, you know, keep themselves afloat and continue to educate students, there clearly is now not just at the college education level where online learning is becoming more and more the norm, but an opportunity for online learning and the corporate interests that back them to get their fingers in the pie of public education. We're going to talk about a lot of the problems, but in addition to that online learning having the effect of essentially automating the work of a teacher, of essentially allowing it to be done cheaply, it also, online learning as an experience for the student creates even greater divide in education, because people who don't have those resources parentally or socially or economically, who have not, maybe their parents weren't as educated, maybe their parents don't have access to technology, they're even more shut out of the online experience than people who do have those skills, or their parents have those skills and can help them. So the degree to which we public educators embrace online learning is we are only taking a gap that already exists within public education because of public education under capitalism and expanding that gap of education experience. And so we really need to resist the belief that, oh, we got to jump into public education right now. Let's do distance learning. Let's do online learning so we can get our kids all hooked up. I will talk about ways we could hook our students up that would help them, but they have nothing to do with actually grading, with nothing to do with like the normal role we think of as public education of like, I'm going to give you an assignment. Now, I'll talk more about that in, I think that's what's behind a lot of us who are doing this work to try to disrupt and get in the way of what looks like a steamroller of distance learning that's going to move across public education now.
Right. Real quick. Yesterday, just because you're talking about these disparities being, you know, cemented or just expanded, right? Like accessibility to certain technologies and things. Yesterday, I was able to talk to two kids. One kid is in a public school in San Francisco. I'm trying to protect their identity.
Yeah.
The other kid is in a private school in San Francisco, you know, where, like, I think it's like $40,000 a year.
Right.
To give an idea. And so the public school kid is, you know, basically they're just trying to figure out what the hell, you know, while the private school kid, they're having Zoom meetings, you know, their school paid for Zoom, you know, for premium Zoom, so they can have meetings with their teachers. It turns out that in that school, like, every kid has an iPad, you know, in the private school. So they have also platforms that university uses to interact with kids. They're already, you know, interacting with this technology. Also, in this private school, there are video games everywhere. You know, they encourage kids to interact with technology, and they have laptops laying around in the hallway, video games.
Yeah.
They also use fingerprints to do transactions in school, which, you know, brings up another set of... But it just shows, again, this is a vast disparity, you know, of a kid that goes to private school, you know, and it's getting ready for a, you know, capitalist world, technological world, and the other kid, you know, has a lot more to catch up to. And but, you know, I think we'll expand on that later. But
yeah, and I want to say that as a teacher who works in a school, which is, for in terms of historically testing and things like that, we don't do very well on testing. We have 70 to 80% of our students get free or reduced lunch because, you know, they come from families that are poor. 50% of them Latino, many of them coming from families where they're undocumented, and African-American students. Basically, a school which is a public school, which is sort of represents some of the often students that are have the most challenges around education as well as other things. That these difficulties are magnified there, but there will be public schools that are actually going to be, in some ways, closer to what you're talking about, that private school experience. And, oh, we're all hooked up, we're all online, we're ready to go. And I'm going to contend that teachers have to understand, we're not ready to go until we're all ready to go. And if you're a public school teacher, I would also include a private school teacher, and you're not worried about what's happening at those schools on the east side, on the east side in San Francisco, the ones that are tend to serve some of the poor students, then you're missing the point about what's really taking place in public education. So that's one of the things we're trying to get at, is this is not just an issue for a single school. This is an issue for all public education, and I would say all educators and all people to be worried about.
All right. So, Andy, how do you want to, should we read this then? You put you and what group?
Yeah. So
put out some.
I sent to, so today we released a group called Strike Ready SF, which is a group of rank-and-file educators who really came together around the Oakland strike when we tried to pull a lot of our schools into doing a one-day sick-out, and maybe if with the idea of expanding that. We were only partially successful in that, but in doing that, we in doing strike support with Oakland, we recognized each other and came together around the idea that we felt our union has to do the same thing. We wanted our union to join Oakland in their strike and do like a solidarity strike. We were unsuccessful pulling that off. But as we saw our contract coming, and our contract is coming up this year, it ends at June 30th, we really came together to really push the idea of, well, you hear it, Strike Ready SF, to be strike ready, to advocate for a strike, to advocate for demands that were aggressive so that you would need to strike, so they could really, like, we don't want tiny little concessionary things. We wanted big demands of class size and wage increases for paraprofessionals who would see a huge wage gap, special ed resources, as well as caseload limitations for special ed educators, a lot of things. We felt like the center of that argument was to be, we have to be ready to make big demands, and we have to be ready to strike to do that. And that largely, I think, is what animates most of the group. And that certainly is what animates my feeling within it. So that's what the group's about. It's rank and file educators within United Educators of San Francisco. And then when this thing hit, I think we basically had to figure out, what do you do now when we're being essentially put into quarantine? And I think a lot of us felt like the big issue that was coming our way was this distance learning and online learning. So We put together a statement, which I'm going to post on this thing, but this is a little flyer of it. And it says, Strike Ready SF, our stance on distance learning. And I guess I'll read it. And we have some demands, things we reject and demands, and we talked beforehand. Maybe we'll go through those one at a time and discuss why they are what they are. So here's what it says. Our stance on distance learning. The COVID-19 pandemic and the resulting social and financial hardships of mass quarantine have created and perpetuated existing trauma for our community. Students, family members, and educators carry real fears of losing loved ones, jobs, homes, and even our own health. This moment creates unique challenges to public education, which must be fundamentally grounded in an educator's ability to form a connection with their students and construct learning communities. It has also created a dangerous moment where private interests seek to exploit our collective duress, falsely promising online education as a substitute for the community and transformative pedagogy that can only be found in the physical space of a classroom. In response to the rapid fundamental changes being proposed by SFUSD, San Francisco Unified School District, during the COVID-19 crisis, Strike Ready SF demands that the district adopt an appropriate pedagogy that prioritizes the well-being of students, educators, and the extended community. I don't know if there's any questions about that, but
yeah. So, all right. And you're saying that Strike Ready SF isn't necessarily a caucus or part of the your teachers' union.
No, right. I don't see it as a caucus. I think there are people who might see it as a caucus in the group. I don't see it as a caucus. I see it as a group coming together really strictly around strike solidarity for other unions, other education unions, possibly any striking union, hopefully, and people who want to push for big demands and a strike in our contract round this year.
Right. And it's a collaboration of different teachers in SF or teachers in the Greater Bay Area.
It's pretty much mostly para educators and teachers, counselors, librarians, members of UESF are mostly part of it. We are in connection with other people. We've already in connection with people who are in caucuses in other unions who themselves are trying to push their union. But our members are members of our UESF union, or not members. The people who are part of this grouping are people who are from the UESF union.
Okay, so I'm curious as to what, you know, you teachers and students, what level of interaction are you having during this time? And, you know, what sort of preparation was done in anticipation, or if there was any at all?
Right.
You know,
I can only speak for myself and my school. And I think it's worth getting into that before we get into the demands in many ways, because mm-hmm. this is where things are at. First off, when we knew by literally the day before we were going to shut down was the day that we heard about it, that, you know, that we were going to be gone until April 6th. And that means 2 weeks of the school closing, then the third week would be spring break. And then the idea was we were going to reopen on April 6th. So we only had that Friday to prepare. And that Friday, people heard about it Thursday evening. And so on that Friday, we had very few students in class. So, for example, I have two sets of physics class. I have a mainstream physics class, which teaches English, people who know English well, that's their primary language, and an EL physics class. And my EL physics class, that's English learners I'm teaching physics. In reality, I'm an English teacher teaching EL students English using physics. Those were my classes on Friday, and they were very poorly attended. And on that day, I basically got them. I tried to get them set up on how to use an email, how to send an email. Only a very few students that were knew actually how to send an email on their phone. Many of them don't know how to do an attachment. But I showed them that how to send me an email and give me an email that they might be accessible to. But in all cases, it was like maybe anywhere from 30-40% of my class to 25% of my class on those three classes that I taught on that day. And that was where I first saw what a big issue this was going to be, because, you know, it's not like mainstream students necessarily know so much about sending emails, but our EL students really are not clear about how that works. The other thing was, is I let them know we might be going beyond April 6th. And the message from our school at the time, like we got early on, was like, you know, okay, the students are not working, but you're kind of going to be working. You're not going to be at school this first week, but then the second week you might be coming to school, and be ready to set up your Google Classroom so that you can kind of get some assignments rolling. So, you know, we can start doing that. And so that was the message we were getting from our administration, and we weren't getting really anything from the district. So I would just say that in our school, our administration was very much seeming to be pushing the idea that we were going to be moving towards grading potentially. And I was quite clear, and I think others were, that I told the students, I'm not grading anything. Like, you can send me some makeup. We can do some makeup work for the assignments that you didn't make do when we were actually in the physical classroom. And you can ask me for some enrichment stuff. Like, if you want to do some assignments, additional ones, or you want to do extra credit. Like, there were a few students who contacted me who wanted to do an extra credit assignment around gravity. Somebody wanted to do something around acceleration, and I just sent them some assignments to work on. But by and large, you know, I was like, I'm not going to grade you on any of this stuff. And so finally the district did come out and say something about that. And like, the district kind of slowed down our own school, which was, I felt, was moving forward on, get your Google Classroom set up. That Google Classroom is basically an online classroom where you want all your students hooked up to it, and you send them stuff, you send them assignments, they send you back stuff, and you grade it. That's how it would work. And the district basically said, look, no grading should be going on. If at best, it should be enrichment, and I agree with that, right? And then they came out with the May 1st. Now we're staying closed until May 1st, and now the district is really basically saying that by April 13th, well, we should be starting on Google Classroom, and that's when the grading is going to start, as far as I can tell, because the district has not been clear about that, and so we want to get ahead of that and basically try to make it so that we don't think any grading should go on as one of the demands while a student's not in a classroom, and where we can't assure that everyone has the chance, access to equipment, access to internet, they know how to use it. I need to know that I had 100% of my students potentially able to access the education if they came to my class before this crisis hit. How am I going to say, well, you know, 30% of you aren't hooked up, forget you, let's move on. You know, that is not the way we want to, in a crisis which is creating all sorts of issues of separation and quarantine, I think it's even more important that we actually say we're all on board now, you know. And secondly, I don't think the most important thing to be doing with students is being like giving them assignments. But again, I'm sort of getting into the demands. So that's my snapshot of where things are at right now.
Do you know if in your school you were using Google Classrooms before?
Some teachers did use it as a framework for getting students classes and things like that, assignments and things like that. I didn't. And there's some who do and some who don't.
It was supplementary, not required, right?
Yeah. It was always seen as like a tool, and I think that's a reasonable way to use it. But also at the same time, just because you have your Google Classroom when everyone's coming to classes, when everyone's away from the class, you don't really know who's reading that, who's seeing that. That's the thing about the physical presence of the teacher, is not only we get to see the faces who are there, we get to see them interacting with the work and see, do they understand it? Do they know it? Are they checking out? Do they have their head down? Are they fooling around? You get to see all that stuff. Here, and dealing with that is not babysitting, it's part of education. Dealing with those things is a part of what it means to be an educator, is to try to figure out how to bring everyone through that, or how to say, hey, this is not going to work here. I'm going to kick you out of the class for a little while, then you're going to be brought back, and then you can kind of come back in. All that's part of the matrix of education. And so if I can't have that interaction with the students, and the students can't interact with each other, I don't believe there's any learning going on, honestly. I think it's just the people who are going to be accessing the online education are the ones who already have the education and are going to be fine.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that are really trained to access these tools and, you know, interact. And I mean, you just mentioned a bunch of the layers. You know, some kids don't even have internet or, you know, a computer. I mean, these two kids that I mentioned earlier, they live in the same household, and they have vastly different experiences of education.
Yeah.
Because one goes to a private school on scholarship, and the other one doesn't. And, you know, so while one is basically continuing their education, and yeah, there are still, like, a lot of discretion, you know, a lot of stuff is left to discretion of teachers, even in a private school.
Yeah.
You know, as to how they're using these tools, but the fact that they already have access to this, you know, facilitates things, you know, and again, some kids are going to have basically lost time.
Yep.
And so they're supposed to, you know, during this period, you know, basically we're reaching the end of the year. They're basically losing, what, like a month?
Yeah.
You know, of education. While some kids lost that month, other kids continue to, you know, learn and enrich. And then they have to compete, right? Like for access to, you know, like spaces in education and like higher education, like universities and stuff.
Yes, but I also will say, because that I do think that that's true, that they will have to compete, but I do believe that even if all these private schools are moving on, and even if some public education are ready to moving on, it is incumbent on those who are not in that situation to slow the roll and not just to use the pressure of that competition to say, okay, we got 80% of you and let's move. Because when you leave behind students don't like watching other students left behind. In your classroom, they do recognize, hey, this person's being the fool in the class. You should kick them out. Da da da. Da. But they want to see. They want to see that when that person comes back in, that you're going to respect them and treat them like nothing. You know, like nothing happened. We're going to get started. If they feel a teacher is like, you know, okay, there's a set of students you don't teach. They don't respect that. They'll do the work sometimes, but they don't respect that, and they're right not to respect it. And this moment more than ever is a moment where students may not be able to hold us accountable for that equity. But we have to hold ourselves accountable for it if we're going to even pretend that there's something such as public education that says, you know, we all move forward, particularly at a time when we're being atomized and scattered. So I understand that pressure. But if there's some students in my class who want some enrichment stuff, I'll give it to them. But I want to give you an example of what happened with really, I have maybe 80 or 90 EL students this year, all right? Maybe about 40 or 50 mainstream students this year. Of my top five EL students, the ones who are, this kid is definitely going to be mainstreamed next year. He's ready to go. He's doing great work in one of my EL classes. He sent me an email for an additional assignment, like an extra credit, because he's got 100% already. And I said, okay, here's a gravity assignment. And then 2 days later, he sends it back to me. And again, this is a top EL student. He says, hey, Ms. Lipson, here it is, you know? And there was nothing on there. And I was like, hey, student, there's nothing on here. And he sends me something again, and there's still nothing on there. And I said, hey, let's talk. So I sent him my phone number, and we talked on the phone. And it was clear he didn't know what that little paperclip button meant on attaching. He didn't know that that's how you would do it. He didn't even know what that thing was. He just thought, just send me back the message, because he had done the work, and he sends me back a message, figures it's done. Secondly, he was working on his phone. He had done the work on a computer. He didn't understand that the work on a computer doesn't necessarily sync up with your phone and that you would go from there. He just thought, okay, these are all computers of some sort. They just send you. I get it. But he just didn't understand that, you know. So, lastly, he didn't know he had to save his work on that assignment. He didn't know he had to press save to keep it. So there are many, and this, again, this is a top-level EL student who is super smart, but just doesn't know some things about technology because it wasn't his, that's not where he came from. So we are assuming all sorts of things that we've learned that, again, that would have been our job, to give our students prepared while in school for at least a week, just to get them ready to do some of these things and to see where the gaps are. And he's at the top. I guarantee you drill down deeper into the EL experience, you're talking about kids, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do. Particularly if it's all done remotely, we're trying to teach them remotely how to do remote things. Forget about it.
Yeah, I just wonder about, you know, again, this push for online education, and this, I think there's an underlying assumption that everyone has knowledge, right? This basic knowledge to have access to technology, and you know, like the technology that's out there. Like if you don't know these basic things, you know, you can't access it. You know, like, they may be the knowledge may be online, but, you know, it's such a little thing that we take for granted because we've learned it, you know, and even then, like me, like, I went to Mission High School, you know, I was, I remember trying to, we were set up with the pen pals, and we were supposed to use emails, and like just navigating that thing was difficult, and we weren't really engaged. I wasn't really engaged into that because we were engaged. We were exchanging you know, messages with kids in like private schools in Marin, the other side of the bay, you know, like the rich county. And so we like, whatever, it was just another thing. Like, yeah, we weren't interested because we didn't know how, you know, it's, yeah, but just yeah. My experience.
And here's the tragedy, the additional tragedy. He actually did the assignment. Like, I asked him some questions. He knew some of the things. He actually got something out of it, but there was no record of that. Like, mm-hmm. And I just said, hey, if you wouldn't mind, just do it again and take a picture of it and just send me that picture. You know, don't even bother saving it. Just send me the picture off your phone. You know, and it was, I mean, it's just the levels of unfairness in that whole experience. You know, just further convinced me that we cannot move forward on this and think that we're grading students. We can, and honestly, for this student, his thing right now is to do some of those assignments. He wants to learn, but that's not necessarily where other students are at. And the first thing we have to find out is where are they at? Not just physically, where are they at? Where are they emotionally and mentally at? And what do they need? And that's really what we need to be carrying through them through this until May 1st. And that has nothing to do with grades.
I remember a conversation that you and Eduardo had, you know, and which I didn't jump into, but you were talking about how, this was off camera, you know, but you were talking about how basically education, you know, some kids, especially kids that are learning English, you know, because I know this is happening in another school. I know a counselor that's, he's been forced to label kids as, you know, kids with special needs or special ed. And because in order to get them more resources. To some degree, that's kind of like throwing them to the side, from what I hear. And but my point is that you both kind of agreed that if anything, we all need personalized education. Right. Everyone does. Right. We cannot be treated like chickens in a massive coop.
Right.
You know, and just expect everyone, because basically you're asking people to sink or swim. You know. But just wanted to bring that up, that you guys talked about that topic, and you know, I just find it in relation to, again, treating everyone like, you know, just a massive production, and
And I want to just quickly put out there that the SFUSD did provide free internet connection at home during this time. There are families are eligible for public assistance programs such as the National School Lunch Program, Housing Assistance, Medicaid, SNAP, SSI, and others, as well as internet connection for students that may not have it.
But remember, providing is different than whether they have it and whether they know to go get it and have claimed those. SFUSD, I think, is doing everything they can do that. I mean, as far as I can tell, to try to get people hooked up and things like that. But they can put out there that these things are there. They can call the families. But the fact has that family shown up, got themselves hooked, and got themselves educated. Is that what that family's at right now? Is there somebody who has been laid off in there, or is there somebody who's out of work who's actually got something else going on? Is that a story that's happening right now at this moment? Are there stories about people being laid off, about people being furloughed, about people not having work? That's what's going on for people out there. So, look, I get it, but SFUSD has to understand that that's a great thing. It's good that they're providing meals too, and the meals are being provided not just to students, but to families that have nothing to do with the public education system per se. I 100% support that. But let's not confuse providing something for people having access to it or knowing how to use it. That's a big difference.
One of the families, you know, that through community work I've been helping, the mother, you know, she migrated from, you know, a country, and she recently reached out because she didn't know how to accept the offer that the school district gave her, because they had to go to online and this and that. And so she was risking not accepting that offer and losing the school placement because of such a simple thing. And especially now, because she could go to, you know, the SFUSD offices, but it's closed. You know, to accept that, you have to go online, and she didn't know how. So again, I had to create a an email. I had to, you know, and basically doing it for her, because otherwise she's going to lose that placement that she fought for a long time. And so it goes even, you know, like at the beginning steps of just getting enrolled to school.
Right. And let's think, remember another group. Are there children of undocumented workers at our school? Yes. Do those undocumented workers feel like they're going to go to that school and give a, are they going to, do they wonder, am I going to be asked for a social security number when I go and try to get a computer? What do you think?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if that happens, what happens then? Does that information get processed by ICE? Do
well,
I get picked
on.
Up?
I don't know if that's happening, Andy.
I'm just saying
that
is the fear.
Have.
I'm not saying it's happening, Eduardo, but think about the situation for the undocumented who are being completely left out of this entire equation of stimulus package. Do they know what's going to happen? I actually don't. I know that SFUSD is going to try to protect them, but you don't know. You don't know. I wouldn't certainly assume it. So we cannot take this from the framework of the effing bureaucracy. We have to understand this from the framework of the undocumented. And so I get it. So, and I'm not blaming even a well-meaning set of people, but this is our bureaucracy. Our bureaucracy is a bureaucracy about social security numbers, about are you here or are you not? Are you a citizen? Are you not? That's the truth, and our schools can try to protect them, but the fact is there's a giant ICE and police web that will pick people up if you're not very careful.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we face making food drops, you know, groceries and stuff for certain people. They want to make sure that first it's not government help, and then they can trust me, or they can trust the people that are making these drops, because, again, there is this real anxiety that any step, you know, just like, could get him, you know, entangled in this fucking system, you know, of persecution. And, yeah, so I think that's very fair to say.
And let me be clear. I believe that the people who are working within the system of public education that I'm working with, they know this. They're doing everything they can to try to make people feel safe. But let's be clear. That means this is just going to be that much slower trying to get this whole thing up and set up. But do I, as a teacher, say, well, I got to move forward with my class. Let me know when you get those undocumented in. Because I'm going on. Because there's a competitive system of education going on there that I need to get the people who are ready for college. No. Like, that is not the way to proceed.
All right. So let's go into the demands and the rejections that you and this group, Strike Ready SF, have put out and are really demanding in the midst of COVID-19.
Yeah, thank you. So first, you can see, I mean, I'm going to put little images in the, if you're watching this on BitChute or YouTube, you'll be able to see it. Otherwise, you're just going to have to listen. But you see there's a side that says, we reject, and next to the reject, it says, we demand. I don't know. Let's try that. So I'll read the first we reject is, we reject language and efforts to hold students accountable to the school system's definition of education to maintain a sense of normalcy during conditions of unprecedented crisis. We demand, instead, trauma-informed pedagogy led by wellness experts that trains educators to recognize and respond to our own trauma and prepares us to empower youth to meet this unprecedented moment together. So what this means, unless it's maybe it's not obvious, is what we're getting right now is education about online learning. How to use Zoom? How to use this? How to get your Google Classroom set up? That is not the education we need. I can say we do need maybe some things about technically how to use Zoom and stuff like that so we can communicate with each other, and then maybe we can teach students how to communicate with each other. But the biggest thing we need is really education and professional development from our wellness center, from people who are in the community dealing and who know about what's going on financially with students. And that's the starting point for this. The things we need to be learning is how to deal with the trauma of this moment for us as educators, but then how to help students identify and deal with that. There are students right now, I was talking to my colleague, there are students who are in households under extreme stress. What happens in households under extreme stress? Fighting, conflict, all that kind of stuff. And those students now are there 24/7. What does that mean for them? Like, that's a big deal. And I don't think that's just a few students. That's a lot of students. So what the moment right now is to reach out and try to figure out how do we get in touch with our students. And then really, it's not about how do we form a classroom so I can assign grades and assess, give them assignments like that. It's about finding out from them, what do you need right now? What would help you right now? If I did get a class together, if I was able to construct a Zoom class, I would first say, well, what do y'all want to do here? Like, this is a physics class, but F physics. What do y'all want to do right now with this moment, you know?
And nor is there a safe public space like a library for access.
Right, right. So, you know, one idea that our health person had, which I thought was great, and again, this is why I think our health people should be leading our PDs, not our tech people, he's like, could we be teaching kids Zoom or these things so they can get in touch with each other? Because they've been split up among each other, and they're friends with each other. And yeah, I can know they can talk, but what would that mean for them to be able to organize conference calls with each other? Like, that to me seems meaningful, you know, if that's what they would want to do, you know. So, and I think a lot more learning comes out of them trying to shepherd each other through this moment more than me having them learn about sound or light.
Why is the language around this an issue for your group?
It's like the language of accountability is, let's get our classroom started up so we can do this. Like, it's that kind of stuff. That's what we mean by the language of accountability is, let's get our classroom started up so we can get those assignments to all the students so we can start taking those assignments in and grading and get things back to normal. And that's what we mean. And I feel like that's what we mean when we say we reject language and efforts. Oh,
do you find, but before we move on, do you find that the Centers for Food that SFUSD has provided isn't a part of recognizing that that is a response to trauma?
Yeah.
And maybe not having access to food security, haven't they provided that so that the students can have access to food?
Yes. Yeah. And now they, that's exactly right. So now bring us as essentially disaster workers in on that project. So our role right now is to assign work. Our role right now is to meet the needs of a pandemic in the context of an economic crisis largely brought on by the quarantine and by other things that were already problems in the economy, you know. So that's the moment right now, and to do it under situations where we're scattered. So yeah, I think the food thing fits. It's the cafeteria workers who should be leading this, if you want to give, I'll put it that way, right? They're the ones who are doing the kind of work that we should be doing, which is to help people meet their needs. And I don't know what me teaching about electricity or light is going to do at this moment, other than to just be, you know, it's not the moment for this.
Let's go on to the next reject.
Okay. So we reject a business as usual approach, which emphasizes assignments and grading, which police students' behaviors and confuse their sense of priorities during pandemic. And we demand suspension of all grading until we can return to our physical classrooms with our students. And I mean, I think we've already been talking about this one. And I want the, once our district said we were going to May 1st, but once they said, secondly, that we're going to getting people lined up for Google Classroom April 13th, that, to me, that implied, okay, we're starting grading. And I think they need to basically say, we're not doing any grading until we're physically back in the classroom again. And if that doesn't happen, then there's no grades that are, no assignment is being done for grades. An assignment can be done to learn something if you're curious about it, to do something else or what have you, but no assignment will be given over this format, this remote format, that's going to be used to give a person a grade that will mark them for their future.
Something I wanted to say is that though there weren't any grades that were going to be given before March, though, right? Yeah. So this time period there aren't going to be any grades for this time period, though. So yes. I'm just trying to figure out, how does your rejection and demand fit in with that? Because teachers aren't necessarily having to grade their students during this period of time. All of the work they're grading are before March.
Yeah, or while we were in the classroom. That is true, and that they finally got that message out maybe about a week ago. But I can tell you, even in our own school, there are people assigning graded work that had to kind of call that back. So why did they say that? They said that because the implication in our school was we were trying to get back to normal. And it's not just our school. I know at Lowell High School, people are doing Zoom classrooms and their assignments being given. So that to me, like, okay, get it. I get it. But I don't agree with it. Like, I know for a fact there are students being left behind. And I think it's a mistake. And I think the district, if it was this demand is being put to the district to say, we want you to be clear about throwing this grade thing out. And they don't want to do it because they do have a finance, like, they're worried that the state, if they tell the state that we're not giving any grades, that Governor Newsom's going to say, well, you're not going to get your money. I'm sure they're worried about that. Secondly, there are online interests who want to see, who want a proof of concept. And these are people who the district has connections to, like groups like Pearson and such, where they do standardized testing to show, look how you could also do this in online. There are charter schools that have all online schools. You could have your grading system work online. And we have to know that this is where they're trying to head with us. And so we have reasons to stop grading because of the actual real needs of the crisis. But I also think it's a way to tell those corporations that want to push an online system, you're not going to get us to do this, you know, this little game and get us caught on your hamster wheel, let alone the students caught on the hamster wheel of remote assignment, turn it in, grade it, remote assignment, turn it in. The minute they get us caught up in that, the minute we are moving along that whole online public education experience.
As of right now, when are students going back to school?
They're not going back to school any earlier than May 1st.
Right.
If that. Any earlier. That is the earliest possible date in San Francisco and in six other school districts. That they're
and school back. Is officially over?
June 2nd or 3rd. One question that exists is, will we extend the year? Let's say we came back on May 1st. Mm-hmm. Would we extend the year? I'm not super excited about that, but I think depending on what the needs of our students coming back, I could see, but we'll have to see. We'll get to there when we get there.
Right. Let's go on with the rejection.
So we reject the movement to online learning as fast as possible because some students are ready to move on with instruction, and we demand no district-wide online plan move forward until all teachers are trained to set up an online classroom and all students have district-provided access to internet technology and knowledge of how to use it, including EL students and students with IEPs and 504s. IEPs are individualized education plans. 504s are students who have health problems health issues that make it harder for them to access the class. Sometimes it's deafness, sometimes it's vision issues. It might not be anything cognitive, but there might be some health issues that make it difficult for them to access the work. And the operative word is all. All teachers, all students. That those to me feel like they need to be like 100%, you know. Mm-hmm. And if it's not that, then there's no reason to move on with any sort of normal classroom.
All right. So here is
I just see a potential critique here. You know, what would you say to someone that says, well, you're holding those, you know, you're punishing some kids, you're holding some hostage, you know, for the rest. What would you say to that?
I would say no. Here's what I'd say. It's like the students who are ready to move on are going to be fine. Like the students who want those enrichment lessons, who are just like, hey, Mr. Lipson, can you send me this? Those students are going to be fine, are not going to be really held back as a result, because they're already bought in to their own education. The actual work that a public education teacher has to do is mostly with the student who's not there. That's where all our work is. It's 3% of our attention is, hey, here's an assignment for you. I'm going to send it to you. You do it. You get it back to me. I'll look at it. I'll give you some feedback. Oh, you want something else? We'll do that. Okay? That's 3% of my work right now. 97% of my work is with the students who aren't here right now, because those are the students who literally are going to, as they fall through the cracks of public education, are they returning next year? Do they see a reason to return next? Do they think they lost the year? Did they end up getting all Fs on their report card? So it's out for them? Like, and that's actually no, that's kind of the truth, even when they're all in the classroom, that most of my work is with the students who are most, you know, who have the most difficulties. But it's even more true now. And so that is the work of a public education teacher, is to find those students who are, like, not there and get them there. I would say that a teacher who says that, oh, but look, these students are ready, they have it backwards in their mind. Those students who are ready are going to be fine, and they're going to educate themselves. And all we have to do is catalyze the reaction. What our real work is building the infrastructure that students who don't know how to use this can use it in some way, and then finding out what is their needs within that. And then maybe after that gets met, we can talk about assignments, maybe.
Yeah. And one of the things, so recently I went to one of the teachers at Mission High School. They pulled me in and they asked me to talk to kids. And one of the things that I told them that I believe is that we go to school to learn how to learn. You know, we go to school, you know, and then you go to a university and you learn a particular frame to analyze the world through that frame. But in reality, what you're doing is learning how to learn. Because, you know, learning won't stop after you leave school, after you get either a certificate or a license. You keep learning, but, you know, if you have the tools, you will be okay. So I see what you're saying, you know, about, you know, focusing on the kids that need to engage and, you know, make it applicable and personalized and, you know, and make it meaningful to them so that they're interested. Because a lot of, you know, I think, you know, if you're not interested, you disengage, obviously, and if you have other pressures. But, you know, just my piece of thought on that.
Yeah, and that your own experience in our public education system is an example of that, where, of course, I think you almost might think of most of your education as happening after you left high school and after you left college, but there was a framework that was established there that was kind of BS, actually, but you were able to learn enough so you could go back and critique the BS and see that it was BS. But if you don't have a certain starting point, you're screwed.
Yeah, it's true. You know, so, and I was lucky that I migrated, you know, I came here to EL classes, didn't speak the language, but I was lucky that I came from a framework of, from a private school in Central America, you know, but again, I'm not advocating for private schools. It just happens that that one was okay, because there's plenty of examples that are horrible. They're just in it for money, you know, and not only that, my mother was an educator herself. She never practiced, but she studied, and education was a priority in engaging and making it, you know, enjoyable. And so I was one of the lucky ones that maybe you could say I fell through the cracks at the end, because I didn't graduate college. I said, fuck it.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't mean that I'm an idiot. I'm completely capable of understanding things and analyzing the world. I'm just not a professional. I'm not certified, you know, but I agree. And I was fine, you know. And I, for the most part, I was fine. You know, teachers knew that I was going to be motivated and engaged, so they didn't have to worry about me.
Right.
But, yeah.
So first off, I would say that what I think students would find valuable in education is the element of education that is liberatory. That is the thing that they will find. And I will say, and Eduardo, I don't want to go down, but I do think that you uniquely found something liberatory in your educational experience in relationship to what you grew up with. And you know what we're talking about, Jehovah's Witness and that whole confinement. For you, you could see the liberatory element what's that called in college? A humanities-like education, on a fuller education they give. So for you, you could see, I can liberate myself through that. But the vast majority of students, and I'm going to include myself as a teacher, most students who were in my classroom, they might, you were already a teacher, you're a good teacher, but they would say, I didn't learn anything. They're going to say that, and I'm going to agree with them, because by and large, the framework, what they were seeing was the framework, and they are penetrating through my desire to reach them, my desire to make them interested in this, and they're seeing that ultimately what I'm laying for them is a trap. What I'm laying for them is the trap of buy into the system and go become a worker. And that is they're the ones who see more truly the actual situation they're in than most teachers think, because most teachers think of themselves as liberators. You know, I'm going to get you out of this. I'm going to make socialism my classroom. And even though the world sucks, I'm going to turn this into a better place. That is a myth. And the students all students have curiosity. There is no such thing as a lazy student. I don't believe in a lazy student. I do believe you can kill a person's desire to learn. And so the people who don't value education are the capitalists. The people who don't value education are the people who design this public education system to be built into a machine that dispenses grades so we can decide where on the workforce you're going to be. Those are the people who have no interest in education. But that is the system we work in, and they're the ones who are responsible for it not reaching people. I work within that. I'm not responsible for it, but that's my job. I'm in that system. But I agree with Kenny that those students who are saying that, I know they're painting a broad brush, but by and large, they're talking about a truth that is not just a perspective truth, but they're penetrating into an actual reality when they say it. That's my belief.
And I think, like, just putting it back to online education, I feel like there's a danger in this, in like becoming a big sifter, you know, and because that's how you end up with people that have the same ideology in the business, in tech, because they sift certain people, a certain kind of person, and they reward them handsomely, and then they have power, and they perpetuate that system. So this is going to be a sifter of who is willing to sift through this, you know, swim through this shed, who's willing to do that, and they believe that ideology of meritocracy, that they did it so that everyone else can. And everyone's, you know, if you're behind, it's your own fault.
Right. And particularly if you're a brown person or a black person, and we find that person who's willing to do that, we can put them up there and say, this is not a racist system. Look at them. There's no racism here. Look at them. You just weren't willing to work hard enough. You weren't willing to put your nose to the grindstone. That's the danger that Kenny's revealing or talking about.
All right. So let's carry on. So, Andy, let's read the next rejection.
Okay. The last one is, we reject disaster capitalism. We reject the influence of private companies that are swiftly taking advantage of the crisis to promote their profits over pedagogy and to dismantle public education with labor-saving schemes and attempts to automate the work of the educator. Mm-hmm. And we demand affirming the necessity of direct student and teacher interaction as essential to learning by submitting a plan for exiting distance learning prior to proceeding with it. Online learning must remain supplemental to a classroom community, not an alternative to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you want to expand? Do you want to share your thoughts on that? That's the statement put out by your group. What do you personally want to supplement or add to or expand on?
I mean, I guess the two things are about privatization and automation. One is there are a number of companies. Pearson's the one that comes to mind right now. There's a bunch of companies that have connections with our school district that have a vested stake in things like standardized testing. And standardized testing today is done exclusively on a computer. What they are building, these companies, and it's not just Pearson, it's a whole layer of for-profit companies, what they are building is an infrastructure of education to then give to the teacher so they can give them online resources so that those students are prepared to take online tests. And that is the push. And all of that is trying to a way for them to basically get connections to the money that's to be made in education by becoming more the sole resource and the resource a school becomes dependent on to deliver education, not say a textbook, which also often comes from a private company, but these online resources that they control and that they will sell. But I feel like it's more pernicious than that, because they have an idea of going to online schools where you can have, and this is already happening for charter schools that are online, where you can have teachers have 100-to-1 classroom size as opposed to 30-to-1, 150-to-1, you know, and that is labor saving. That's cheaper for them, and they can still say they're delivering an education. Now, the last part is automation. What they want. When auto workers were first having their work automated, what people would do, what managers would do, is they would find the most efficient and the best workers along the line and find out what little motion they would make that was so quick that allowed them to do that. And they would see if they could build a robot to do that motion. They still needed that worker, but I want to just build a robot because this is an important part of your work. So can I get a robot to do that instead of having to pay a worker to do it? Well, that's the situation, and that's how the auto, robotics eventually, essentially, is robots simulating the work of the most efficient workers, and then doing it faster. It's the whole John Henry story of, you know, the thing that drills through the mountain, and John Henry was trying to do it. I shouldn't get into that. Anyway, that's what's happening with us right now. They want us as teachers to be creating online experiences for students that can actually get the most students to move along, that are the most accessible. And we're essentially practicing for those people who ultimately want to automate our job, because ultimately, if I can do it the best of all, if I can become the best online teacher, they're going to use my physics teacher, they're going to use my online lessons to essentially put into AI in the long run to basically have them deliver that and have the feasibility of dealing with all the different students. Maybe even do a better job at teaching online than I could do because it's artificial intelligence. That's where this whole thing goes. This whole thing ultimately is me replacing myself and the teacher being replaced from the classroom because it's going to become cheaper. And not only will I be moved out of the classroom, not only will maybe I become a person in a room somewhere teaching 150 students, but eventually I get removed altogether and artificial intelligence basically replaces me because I've done all the work to figure out what was the most accessible thing. Now, when we say most accessible, it's understood many of those people don't even need to be educated, so let's not worry about them. But how can we do it cheapest? How can we do it fastest? And how can we do it in a way where we don't have these pesky teachers who have unions and are people and have these human needs? We don't have to deal with that. We don't have to pay for that. So that's where this leads. And we enter into this field. We enter down this road at our own peril.
And I imagine, like, you know, you have people like Bill Gates and a lot of these people, like, packaging and selling this as a benevolent thing. And of course, you know, like, I'm not against technology. I love technology. But technology in the hands of capitalists is not liberating.
Right.
You know, and because I do see, you know, because I mean, that maybe is my next question. You know, what role do you see, you know, because you talk about complementary technology, right?
Yeah.
How do you envision that? And do you have a sense of how would you like that to work out? Or
can I actually jump in for
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the back of you, Andy, you have Diego Rivera's jigsaw puzzle of a mural, right?
And man at the crossroads of time.
Yes. And Diego Rivera himself considered himself to be a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
At City College, here in San Francisco, City College, the community college here, there's a large mural with indigenous traditions and peoples, along with innovators of the 20th century, and in the very centerpiece there is this figure. I forget right now what god or mythological creature it was, but half of it was a rope, was almost like a cyborg version of it, and it was a technological cyborg figure with mixed in with a mythological figure from an indigenous culture tradition. It derived from a legend. Anyhow, the point is, Diego Rivera thought that technology was going to be one of our greatest liberating forces in the world. And he thought that if we had technology in a socialist society, that we would not be spending our time as workers doing tedious work that machines could do to produce work, such as maybe some forms of agriculture, maybe even making automation of our clothing. But he saw this in the light of giving people more free time to actually become innovators and to be able to use their power of intelligence and creativity and to expand on our knowledge in a socialist society, and not to be used as worker ants just working for the production of to make things for the capitalists. But that's not how it has been used in a capitalist society. It is a threat to workers. Technology is a threat not all of it, but in this sense, for online distance learning, or even the making of cars, is a threat.
Or truck drivers.
Or truck driver. Because workers in a capitalist society need to survive on these types of jobs to be able to have an income, to survive in this world. And those are a threat. So people do have they do reject artificial intelligence. And even now, there's surgeries being performed by robots. So even the highest paid workers, such as surgeons, I think that's the starting pay, at least in California, is $80 per an hour. A starting surgeon there's a threat to their work. But that's how technology, I think, can be used in a socialist society. And in a capitalist society, it is a threat to workers. And I think there's an exploitation of this during this crisis, this COVID-19 crisis, where they are trying to figure out how can we get rid of workers that unionize? How can we get rid of workers that do have a certain pedagogy they could potentially be instilling into their students? Or how can we get rid of workers that we have to pay and we can reduce those costs as capitalists? So technology it's a double-edged sword, no?
Yeah.
So you can add to it. Both of you can say more to it, and that's how I see technology. And I just thought of it as I saw the mural in the back of you.
Yeah.
For our viewers, they can see it.
And to me, that's another reason why I'm more committed into the revolutionary road of socialism. Rather than a reformist, because this is a classic example of, regardless of the policies that you pass here and there, they'll circumvent it. To make profit, because profit is the only motive, is the only goal, is the lifeblood of capitalism. And when I think about, philosophically about what we do, the way I see it, we work to sustain life, fundamentally. We work to sustain life, but they are stealing our work to make profit for them.
Yeah.
And their job is to squeeze us and even put us in danger, until it's not profitable.
Right.
And so that's why they take jobs to countries that deregulate their industries, because those countries are willing to put their workers, in danger, because workers here have unionized, and they're demanding more. And so long as, we're playing this game that they're somewhere else that will do it for cheaper, then we're all screwed. And we can't fight back. So, yeah. I do think technology has the potential to be liberating. There is space for that, plenty of space in socialism. It just has to be taken away from the grip of capitalism.
Right. I mean, and in addition, first of all, I think, Eduardo, you provided the best framework, I think, for the overall way I see technology, a double-edged sword that is being used against us under capitalism. But it could be great for us if we had a socialist revolution, but largely it's going to be used against us in capitalism. And I think, Kenny, you're right to say that work fundamentally is about staying alive and sustaining life. And the capitalist derails it. For the worker, capitalist derails it from that meaning and makes it about earning a wage and surviving just for the wage. Not surviving for the value of the work that it might fulfill in a place in a community, but making it your individual wage. And that's why work becomes alienated. That's why you're like, even though we kind of do, rely on restaurant workers, and we can see all these different workers we now rely on, particularly within quarantine, they themselves aren't able to experience the actual value. First of all, they don't get paid the value because Congress was worried that those people would get paid more in their unemployment benefits than they were actually at their job, even though these are clearly essential work for keeping a functioning society. But the capitalist profits from that, and the worker never gets to experience that sense of importance of their own work, because their work is only about that particular wage for surviving. And that's what we call alienation.
No, and that's why, we've been put in this position of basic desperation,
right,
and selling, our labor ever so cheaply, I see ourselves in San Francisco as, a lot of the restaurant workers I mentioned earlier in the previous episode as semi-feudal workers, landless peasants.
Right. But I'll just say, and this is, now I'm going to speak about a framework, now I'm speaking from a biased teacher framework for me as a science teacher in terms of the lower question here, like the the less big question you're asking about technology. I do see that I have a role to play in educating students about the technology that's going to be foisted on them, because if they don't know it, then they're going to get effed. All right, I can see that, I grudgingly accept that I'm going to have to perform more of that, because this is partly what I've learned from this experience, is that as much as public education might be able to resist online education, higher education is getting trounced right now and is becoming, I mean, now online is going to become even more of the experience and more part of people's college experience. But let me be clear, there are times I can, you know, use Excel spreadsheets to like show people how to make math equations, or use interesting kind of fun programs that are like video games that show physics concepts. But I'll be honest, there's a project that I do with spaghetti and marshmallows that shows students resonance that they get way more into than that. Or I do something with a wine glass and sound to show resonance when you do the wine glass, but also to take a tuning fork that produces a sound, and they dip the tuning fork into the water and they see the waves that get produced, and they're like, whoa, that's cool. That experience is way more important and cannot be simulated by technology. You actually have to have the physical, like, watch the world around you and see the interesting things that are going on, and see that we have an explanation for that. Is it a right explanation? It's a scientific explanation. It's our best theory for it. It's a theory. It is not fact. It's theory. But we can explain these things from some of these theories. The world can be understood. The physical world you're in can be understood. And I think those experiences to me are more important. That stuff. Can the simulation do some things to add to it? Yeah. And there are some programs that I've found. The vast majority of technology I see are just time-saving things, are little games that actually students might like because they're like a video game. But the level of learning and the level of like, whoa, that's neat, not much of that actually. But mostly what I do see I'm going to need to play more of a role to bring technology in so the students in our school are not as effed when they go out there.
And if I may just add to that, I do not believe, having been an educator in elementary school, it's appropriate to use this sort of form of education for students that are in elementary school. The level of development for a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, these things, there's so many complexities, there's a lot of dynamics that happen in the classroom with a student and teacher interaction that cannot be replaced by forms of online learning. It's just impossible. No matter how many people try to argue for it, it is impossible. Can it be supplementary? Yes. But it will never be able to replace. No matter how much Pearson or online companies try to really push through and create the argument for it, it is impossible. And we are seeing more technology being pushed to our students of younger ages today than older. It's happening. We have like the Z generation, no? But, and the World Health Organization really is advocating that less than an hour of screen time for younger students, developmentally, for the brain, and just the eyes, it's not till right now. It's just not physically. We're human, and humans are social animals, and we need to be face-to-face physically with other people. This, even what we're doing now, is different from being together on the same couch, as an example.
Yeah. No? Yeah, my neck doesn't hurt as bad.
You know, I need to feel the tension in the room. You know,
tension, Kenny. You're making it up.
Well, I don't know if there's anything more that really we've gone through exhaustively that document, and we'll see where it goes. But We are hoping to try to put a monkey wrench in the way of a juggernaut.
Just a question: what kind of traction are you hoping for this?
I would be excited if my school, we all agreed we weren't submitting any grades for anything until we enter the physical classroom. That would excite me a lot. I would be more excited if that happened at other schools as well. I'd be excited if it happened in another school, and then our school started to do it because some other school, like, you know, did it, like June Jordan or what have you. So that meant we were getting somewhere. It's not the whole thing, but it's part of the thing. Because I think if we can get teachers to not do any grading, like, just, you know, I'll tell you about your assignment. I'll give you feedback on it, but I'm not putting a grade in Synergy or in some program that's going to go to a letter that I'm going to affix to something for your transcript. Then I'd be pretty happy about that, and I think we would have put a real hitch in the plans of online education, the privatizers of education who are pushing online education into their plans to get their hooks into us, at least here in San Francisco. If we can stop that, doesn't stop the whole thing, but it would represent a fundamental setback, because if they can get us on the hamster wheel of grading with our students, then they've kind of got us. All right.
Any last thoughts as we're wrapping up? Anything you want to add, Andy?
No, I think this was I appreciate you all taking the time for this thing. I really appreciate, Eduardo, the point you start out with, that this is something for all workers, that all workers are involved in this discussion. And this is not just a teacher thing or even a teacher para thing. And that's a really important framework that I hope people understand.
Yeah. Para is an assistant. And yeah. Some people are not familiar with some of these words.
I should say para educator. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Kenny, do you want to add something? I can't tell.
I'm good.
No? All right. But let's wrap up. Thank you, Kenny, for being here. Thank you, Andy. And I appreciate that we had this conversation. Look forward to next week when we will be talking about, I'm sure, something within the context of the COVID-19.
Can I add one thing?
Yes.
If anybody wants any of the resources we're talking about, you know, send to me in any of the comments or something like that, or you can send a request from our YouTube website email, and we'll give you any of the resources if you want to use them in your school.
We'll have those links on our blog. And on the description box below,
yep.
Whatever platform you're looking at this from.
Yeah,
so for our viewers and listeners, you can please subscribe, rate, review, and best of all, share with your friends and family community. You can find us on any of our 5 platforms on BitChute, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes Podcast, or YouTube. And please leave a comment below. And we hope to have an episode next week. With a different, I don't know what topic we'll be discussing, but it doesn't matter. All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you.
I need to keep in mind, not that I want to dig into it, it's just a simple question. I wonder if Hema maybe feels the same way as I do, Kenny. Maybe she's on the same page as I do. Maybe she could explain it further. Because she's a capitalist. I'm not a capitalist, but... You know, maybe she felt like there was value in education in public school.
I'm not saying that's not the point. But that's not the point at all. I'm not saying on the contrary. I'm saying that we have to make it better, more
equitable. I wonder if she feels. I'm just curious. I sort of find an ally in this.
Well, because I think that maybe I wonder if there's a fundamental, like, philosophical thing here, difference. Because what I'm saying is fundamentally that I think people are curious, people want to learn. For the majority, maybe there are a few people that just don't give a fuck, maybe. But for the majority, I think people want to learn. And it's just a matter of how is it enjoyable and people engage. And that's, you know, that's where I come from. And because what I'm hearing, again, and I might be wrong, we might be even saying the same point, just a different way. But is what I'm hearing is, again, they didn't try it. And again, I'm just making a blanket statement. They didn't try hard enough. And I'm getting into why. How come they didn't try hard enough? You know, like, how come they didn't engage? You know, how come, you know, some kids, because, and again, and I think you and I are pretty exceptional. But, you know, but we cannot be, because I was being used as that tool to say, oh, the rest, you know, you're not trying hard enough. You know, you're not swimming hard enough through the ship. But I understand, you know, and there are layers, you know, complexities, you know, of, you know, even if we have the same boxes, we check the same boxes, there are subtleties that those boxes don't capture. So that's why, you know, I find identity politics is that bullshit, you know. Because it's impossible to capture that nuance, you know. And so, and it's hard. But ultimately, the goal is to engage people and to engage students. And so they take agency of their own education.
All right, let's not belabor the point here, because I know we have to carry on. But thank you, Kenny.
I'm not necessarily going to include that part in it, but I want to include the other part.
Oh, you were recording? Sorry, I wasn't sure.
No, it's fine, because, yeah. Okay. No, but,
that was just for us. We'll talk later.
Yeah. That'll be in the blue.
All right. All right. I cannot see Kenny for some stupid reason. I don't know why my Skype is performing this way.
Yeah.
But I that's why if Kenny is speaking, I'll sort of be listening in to see what you're saying. To see what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's a contradiction. To hear what you're saying.